Thank you so much for inviting me, Jerry. It's a pleasure to be here, and it's a pretty full room. And it's funny, I heard a speaker one time say, when you tell your story, you usually tell three of them. There's one you tell in the car on the way, and then there's the one you tell when you get here, and then there's the one you tell on the way home. And I was thinking, man, I feel good. I didn't think about it at all. And then as soon as, I think it was Mike got up to read, I thought, gosh, I'm nervous. Oh, gosh. So we'll just see where it goes. All right. My name is Meredith McCabe, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Meredith.
My sobriety date is May 30th, 1998. I have a sponsor. My sponsor has a sponsor, and I sponsor other people. My home group is, it's in the book. We meet on Saturday mornings at 10 a.m. at 8111 in the little room, and it's a beginner's big book study. And then we also meet on Sunday nights at 7, and that we go through the entire text plus Dr. Bob's nightmare. And then the last Sunday of the month is a speaker meeting. So that's been my home group for quite some time. Okay, well, I had my first drink when I was 10 years old. I figured, you know, why put it off? It was Thanksgiving time, so I love this time of year. It reminds me of that. And I remember we sat in a big fancy dining room, and we had these really delightful tiny little glasses, and they were filled with champagne, probably about an ounce. And I remember Grandma on my father's side, very straight, you know, no drinking out pretty much on that whole side. But she would say, oh, let the children have a little champagne. What could it hurt? And I had, at that time, there were five children. A sixth one came along later. And I drank my champagne, and oh my gosh, I mean, I got all warm immediately. I loved that tingly feeling when it hit my stomach. I could feel the redness in my neck, in my face, in my ears, and it felt just fabulous. And my sister, I had dinner with my sister last night, and I said, I love that. She goes, I hate it. I said, I know, I drank yours. You know, I drank my sister's, I drank mine, and one of my brother's, and maybe a fourth one. And I got such a buzz, and I remember, I remember having a red dress on with a crinoline underneath, and if you know what that is, then you're in my age group. But I remember doing somersaults. A crinoline makes your dress poofier. So I was doing somersaults, and my crinoline was showing, and I didn't care. And well, that seemed to continue on into my drinking life. But and I remember playing piano for Aunt Ginger, and I hate playing the piano. I mean, it's just like, wow, this is great. And then wow, then I suddenly needed a nap, and I woke up with a terrible headache, but I remember going back to school on Monday and telling my friends, we got to drink champagne on Thanksgiving, and I can't wait till Christmas because we drink champagne at Christmas too. And that was the year I wanted a snuggle bun for Christmas and go-go boots, so I wanted this doll and go-go boots, so I was at a very transitional age, but suddenly I'm thinking about champagne at Christmas, and I'm 10. So when I learned that alcoholism is an illness that centers in the mind but also has a physical component, I think back, oh gosh, I had the obsession right out of the gate. Could not wait. I mean, it wasn't on me like a tiger as it grew to be, but I was thinking about that champagne at Christmas. And I didn't drink it every weekend until I got to be 14. My parents moved us to a very isolated area of upstate New York from the suburbs. It was like night and day. I went from a place that had, you know, big classrooms with all kinds of bells and whistles and SRA reading labs to a place that had wooden desks and lockers and a girl that says, so you're from the city, huh? You know, I was like, oh my gosh, where are we? And my father thought it'd be great to move us up to where there's lots of open space and we could be in nature and all that. But what I came to learn as a young teenager was the only thing to do was, you know, drive the back roads and drink, you know. And at least that's all I could find to do. So I discovered, you know, like Bill, you know, in the midst of excitement, I discovered liquor. That was the blinking traffic light in the middle of town where the cool kids hung out and smoked cigarettes and waited for someone 18 to come by and buy them a bottle of apple wine, which was $1.07, including tax. And I loved apple wine. And so I started drinking on weekends. And at home, I was the oldest girl. My father was not coming home as much. He was working in New York City, 4 hours away. He was coming home less and less. We really didn't fit in up there. If you didn't have one of four last names, you didn't really fit in. And everybody was related. And I remember feeling like I had to work extra hard to feel like I belonged. Although I was always popular. I was athletic. I had no problem taking charge of any situation. So I was always, you know, captain of this or head of that. And I was a really good student. I liked the rewards of doing good. I liked achieving. I liked the recognition. I liked doing the right thing and being dutiful. But as the family started to sort of unravel, I hit the streets on the weekends with the kids, the cool kids, and drink the apple wine and learn how to smoke cigarettes and end up at those keg parties in the woods. And before I knew it, I began leading that double life. You know, I would do things at those keg parties that I wouldn't do if I wasn't drunk, and that by Monday morning in school, knowing that the whispers in the hallway were, a lot of them were about me. And I know that. It's not because I was just paranoid. It's because there was only one hallway. Okay? There were 23 people in my graduating class. So everybody knew everybody's business. And you know, Bill Wilson talked about how he felt so little of himself that he had to achieve more. And that was me. I was the captain of the cheerleading squad. I was in student council. I got the Van Nagelfield Award for the biggest English average or whatever. You know, and I used that to try to make myself overcome what I was on weekends. And this went on all the way through high school. And you can sort of see the progression of my illness just by my nicknames. First I was Meg, and because that was my grandfather called me. Then I was Megaphone, because I had a big mouth. And then it was Mouthy. And then it was Red Face, because I was either always yelling, crying, or screaming, or laughing. And all of that made my face red. And then as I started developing this affinity for boys and cars and apple wine, the nicknames got a little bit, you know, dicier, you know. You know, easy. You know, but I tuned that out, you know. I pretended that wasn't true, you know. And I really thought, well, if people saw what my heart, you know, I'm just looking for love in all the wrong places. And if they just knew my heart, you know, they would know that, you know, all that kind of crap. I remember my best friend saying, I can't go with you somewhere because you have a really bad reputation. And I thought, how did that happen? You know, I'm the good kid. I get the high grades. I love my family. I make the lunches for my brothers and sisters. How did that happen? And I remember I started leading this life that I did not want to live and couldn't seem to not want to live. And I went to college. The alcohol was making decisions for me. I chose the college I went to because the bars were open later than the other college I was going to go to. I went to a women's college because it seemed like, you know, in Bill Wilson's story, there was a mix of alcohol and speculation that turned like a boomerang. For me, it was a mix of alcohol and socialization. And so I thought, I'll just remove my trouble areas, like the dudes, you know, and I'll just go to a women's college. And I thought that would solve it. But they had townies and foosball. And so that, you know, that behavior continued. And it seemed like I would get out of that town just in time. You know, I'd run the four-year course, whether it was high school, move on, go to college. 4 years of college, time to go, you know. And I didn't realize how much fear I had until the week before I graduated. I'd gone in to study nursing, but I soon discovered it wasn't for me. I ended up studying theater and English because I didn't want to address people's physical infirmities. I was more interested in what was going on in their souls. And I think it's because that's what was going on with me. You know, and I didn't want to sit in judgment of people physically. And I studied all these authors, and I learned about character and all these things that I thought I had, you know. But I didn't, you know. The book talks about how we could wish to be moral, and we could wish to be philosophically comforted, but these wishes didn't save us. And I kept a journal, and I found it. I just moved, and I found that thing, and man, I tore that up. I mean, the desperation in my life was evident even at that age. And I don't know how I endured that torture for 20 more years, except that I drank more, and that kind of, you know, kills the pain and that cycle. I graduated college, and I moved to Lake Placid, where I was worked for the Olympic Committee, and it wasn't in the 90s, it was before that. But I made a host of fair-weather friends. I was a big shot. But that only lasted 9 months, and so I had these ups and downs in my life, you know, and I thought I was just everything. But what happened was I ended up just staying in that town and working in bars because bartenders and drug dealers were my heroes. And so I started out as a cocktail waitress and aspired to head bartender. By golly, I got there. And worked my way around the lake. They called it ATL, going around the lake, and now I live in ATL. But I started out at the fancy club and then went to the sort of fancy place and then ended up in the gin mill that was where all the industry workers hung out, and we nicknamed it Hell's Bar. And we just sat around we had like a core of people that just hung out there. So I worked there, and then I hung out there. And when I drank, by this time, I'm drinking, and I've got resentment about my life already, the wrongs my family has done, the remorse about the way I've lived. How did I end up here? I'm so smart. I was valedictorian in my class. I remember bragging about that in college. I was valedictorian in my class. I didn't tell them that the smartest guy graduated a year early, and I got it by default. I was president of student council. But I didn't tell them that the only reason I was president is because I ran unopposed because there was so much apathy, nobody else cared about being the president. So I'm like, I have all these gifts, and yet here I am bartending. And every woman that was bartending that was like 10 years older than I was had a gravelly voice and a really bad attitude about life. And somehow that was a vision for me. You know, I just kind of saw myself going there. And then also the nickname I earned by this point was Nightmare. And it started because I was a bartender, and people say, "Have a nice nightmare." Have a nice, meaning mirror, you know, my name. But I said, "Well, fall out of your bunk." You know, that's not very nice. You know? But that became sort of became my nickname. And if I went out drinking, that's sort of what I became. I mean, and I worked for a woman who owned the bar. Grew up on top of a bar, and her mom was known for being crazy. She walked the streets crazy, and her aunt and uncle raised her, and she owned the bar. And when she got drunk, they called her Cujo. So you can just imagine how lovely that was. And she got drunk early and then, you know, got out of everybody's way. But she'd go for a little tear, and then she'd come back to her own bar looking for someone to dance with her, you know. And the problem was there was no band, you know. And you know, she was a Cujo, you know. And people are like, "Oh, here comes Madeline, you know, sweetheart." And then she cranked the music, and you have to endure the Madeline thing. But then she, you know, she eventually got sober, and we're in touch today, and it's pretty incredible. But anyway, only every now and then did we go out together, because we were like, oil. I mean, you know, I worked for her, we knew we can't hang around too much, you know, we could probably set the world on fire, literally. So every now and then we'd go around the lake drinking together, and they would actually call, the bartenders would call the next bartender and say, "Nightmare and Cujo just left here, lock the doors," you know? So, there's no lie. So I don't know what happens. Now at this point, my alcoholism is progressing. I got a terrible reputation. I'm getting fatter. So I also am getting sloppy when I drink. So I find some powdered alcohol that keeps me awake more and I can drink more. And I really like that. And I would, you know, I would also be a sort of a purveyor. So that kept me sort of always with that, and then my mom's friend, who was really close to the state troopers, called me and said, "You might want to tone it down a little bit because they're watching you." And of course, there's a narc in every crowd. I always thought they were, but now I was sure of it. So I thought I need to move away. So I moved down to Atlanta, and 10 short years later, I got sober. Those 10 years are same stuff, different day. The only thing that was interesting was I was in the restaurant industry and I kept getting promoted. I was able to, you know, pull it off at work and run the show, and then I would go to this dive bar that my staff did not go to, and I would drink. And this is back in the days when there were pagers and no cell phones, and the phone number of the bar was on the Rolodex at work. They knew that if they needed to find me, they could call Whiskers, which is closed now. It's quite sad. So they would, yeah, a lot of people in here were there. So I had 10 years of, you know, going into that bar, you know, five nights a week. And, you know, I drove drunk almost every night, never got a DUI. But I would go into that bar and just in restless, irritable, and discontented, you know. And until I could have that first couple of, I'd have a couple of stiff vodkas or whatever, and then I'm good. But I never stopped there, you know. I drank and drank and drank until 2 in the morning. And I would say that I was drinking with you because there was a room full of all y'all there. But I wasn't drinking with you. I was just sitting next to somebody. And that was my life. And I remember there were certain nights when I didn't want to go and I couldn't not go. I remember on a Sunday night especially. I mean, only losers go out on Sunday nights. But that was the last time to maybe let, you know, the magic's going to happen, you know. You know, that was where the magic was going to happen, was in that bar, you know. And I got my first exposure to Alcoholics Anonymous was this group of people would come in to that bar, and they'd get around a couple big tables and drink. I didn't notice what they were doing until they pointed it out, but they would drink, you know, iced teas and stuff and eat and talk and laugh and talk and laugh. And one night this woman came over to me and she goes, "Man, I was just like you." I said, "Really?" She goes, "Yeah, I'd come in here and drink, and I was the life of the party, and I'd laugh, and then I'd go home and I would cry." And I was like, "Wow, how does she know that?" And she goes, and I don't know how she said it, but I was curious and interested, you know. And she would just sit and talk to me when she saw me. She'd come over and talk to me for a few minutes, and she'd say, "You want to come sit with us?" And she goes, "We just came from a meeting up the street." I never knew what that clubhouse was. It was always there, but I never knew it. It's amazing how this whole underworld exists, and until you show up there, you can be completely oblivious to it. But I didn't want to sit around with a whole table full of people not drinking. That's weird, you know. So, but it was interesting that she, you know, she got my attention. And then a friend of mine got court ordered into AA and had to go to meetings at that place. And I thought I'd be her sobriety buddy, and I'd go just to check it out. And I was like Geraldo Rivera, you know. I'd go in and sit. I'd go to the meeting at 10 o'clock at night. I like that when it's dark, you don't have to really see anybody, and you can like run the gauntlet and leave right after, or even before it's over, who cares? And, you know, so I went with her, and then we go, and I'd listen to stuff, and sometimes I'd share on the topic, obsessing about sex, pick me, you know, whatever it was, you know, but I wasn't doing AA, you know. I was going to meetings, and I really didn't think I was as sick as you all, really. I wasn't hearing, you know, if you want to get sober, you take these steps, a personality change sufficient, blah, 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 you know, great life, all that. I didn't hear that. I heard a lot, and I didn't want, you know. And I would just go to the bar. I mean, I'd go to the meeting, and then I'd leave and go to the bar and drink Diet Coke, because that's the only life I knew. And then my friend, we went to that bar one night, and she was definitely high on something, and I'm like, "You're supposed to be my sobriety buddy." "Well, I guess I don't need to be sober anymore either, you know." So I lasted 23 days, happy, joyous, and free, damn it, you know. You know, just marking off the calendar. I remember, you know, all the friends I had, I couldn't call them. The phone would ring, I couldn't answer it. You know, it was just don't drink and watch blockbuster movies. That was pretty much my program. And I didn't know that I drank again because I couldn't not drink, except that I learned later when I first met my sponsor. I really don't remember if it was 8 months or 18 months that I was out. But my bottom was sort of in three parts. My cousin sends me a pamphlet, who I partied with in the 80s. She'd been going to therapy since she was like six. She was 30 years old. She was always a little way messed up, always more messed up than me. You know, she really had problems. And I got a pamphlet from her one day, and it was called Letter to the Woman Alcoholic. And I was living in my subterranean apartment because I had since stopped living above ground. My last two domiciles before I got sober were underground, basements, not too much light. You know, I would slither out to get a burger and come back to the house on hangover days, you know. Anyway, so I got this pamphlet, and I started reading it. And before I was done with the first page, I was crying. Because it was exactly me. And she didn't put any lectures in there. She goes, "I just wanted to send this because I love you. I have a year sober in AA." I thought, really? And because I knew she, it's kind of like Abby and Bill. I mean, we drank alike. Our mothers are sisters. People say, "Are you sisters?" "No, our mothers are sisters." You know, we're all very, you know, animated and passionate and blah, blah, blah. And insanely drunk most of the time. So she sent me this pamphlet, and I realized I really need to do something. And so that was sort of the beginning. And then I gained a great deal of weight very suddenly. And I remember I didn't ask God for much because I was raised Catholic, but I liked some of the ritual, but I didn't feel God's presence. And certainly there was no action. There was no power in my life from him or any of that. And frankly, after watching my dad leave, my mom cry, become alcoholic herself, dad dying, mom, you know, where's God? You know, this is a mess. So, but I remember thinking, please help me at least with this weight thing. I mean, what's going on here? And it turns out I was diagnosed with diabetes. And my sister was completely freaked out. And I had started, as soon as I got diagnosed, I realized I started losing weight. I'd lost weight really fast, which happens when your sugar is really elevated and you burn all your body fat. And so she's like, you got to get to the doctor and get on medication. I'm like, I'm almost at my goal weight. Can I just wait another week, you know? And and she's like, no, this is really serious. And I remember thinking, you know, it's just like alcoholism. We say, you know, if people just understood what I suffered from, my family doesn't get it, my boyfriend or my wife, whatever it is. I never gave a crap about diabetes till I had it. Why do I expect anybody else to care what I suffer from until I can figure out what it is? You know, so, I mean, all I knew about diabetes was Mary Tyler Moore was the head of some foundation. That's what I knew. And, but then when I found out you can lose your eyesight, you can lose a limb, I had a moment of vanity. And I thought, if I don't get this drinking under control, I'm going to have big Coke bottle glasses, I'll probably have a prosthetic leg. I'll be sitting on that bar in Whiskers going, dance with me, you know? And who's going to dance with a woman with a wooden leg, right? And then I'm going to get mad, and I'm going to throw it at him, because that's what happens when I get pissed off. I mean, I can see that happening. I kid you not. I can see myself do that. So I really knew I wanted to get it under control. And I went to the doctor, and they gave me this medication. And on the bottle, it said, take this with all the meals. And by the way, they had that little martini glass with the no sign. And I felt like the blood rushed out of me. I thought, wait a second, this says I can never drink alcohol as long as I'm taking this medication, and I'm taking this medication for the rest of my life. I thought, I'm really in trouble here. There's a line in the book about a definition of powerlessness that I love. It says, this is the baffling feature of alcoholism as we know it. It's the utter inability to leave it alone, no matter how great the necessity or the wish. Now, I'd begun to wish I could stop drinking back in the 70s when I found myself in the back of every muscle car from here to Westport, New York. But it wasn't enough to make me stop. Okay? So, and then now I'm diagnosed with diabetes, and I'm going to end up with a bad leg, and no one's going to dance with me, and I'm going to probably go blind. And so I'm going to manage it now. So now I'm on this new routine, abstain. Write my schedule, because I'm in charge of a restaurant at this point. I'm a general manager, and I'm about to get promoted to human resources manager. My total job is identifying talent, management talent, across the Southeast, hire them and train them for our company, because I can see talent, okay? So that I'm on the verge of getting this promotion, and I've got to get this under control. So, and it's not unmanageable. I'm writing my own schedule. So I write 4 days off in a row, and then I work 9 days so I can have that binge in there that I need. And on those 9 days, let's just tighten that screwdriver, you know, and just see how restless, irritable, and discontented nightmare can get. That worked for a while until that trip to the southern beach town where I got drunk in a bar in a place that had all of our employees. Now, I didn't know there were our employees because I'm in a different town doing this recruiting, and I show my butt, apparently, not literally, but I flash the band once in a while in Whiskers, but that doesn't really count. So I show my rear end a little bit, and my boss calls me about a few days later and says, hey, I got to meet with you. Anytime today would be good. I'm in Atlanta. It was Sunday morning and he was calling me. And he lives in Myrtle Beach. And now he's in Atlanta and wants to meet with me. And so I'm scared to death. I meet with him and he says, do you remember doing this? And I had a vague recollection of that, you know, shadowy recollection. And he goes, you've got to stop this. You know, and I said, you'll never have to have this conversation with me again. And he goes, you got to go and make these things right. You got to go talk to this general manager that you said yada yada about. And I said, you will never have to have this conversation with me again. And when he said it, I knew I didn't trust myself enough to know if I'd keep that promise. And my job was all I had left. You know, the book talks about how with the alcoholic illness goes the annihilation of all things worthwhile in life. That's my definition of a bottom, because I had some really nice crap. I had a nice car, a nice house, a nice job, but they didn't mean it. They were reduced to nothing. They didn't mean anything to me. They couldn't bring me out of it. And I was sinking lower and lower in this place of intense self-loathing and uselessness and futility. And the depression had advanced so much that I was having suicidal thoughts that were unwanted. So when I learned later that an obsession is a persistent and often unreasonable idea or emotion that cannot be put out of the mind, I got it. Even before the alcohol, I was used to thinking about it. I gotta stop doing this. When did it become we? You know, at some point, I'm talking to myself in terms of we. because I'm so split apart on the inside. The part of me that doesn't want to be this way, the part of me that can't help being this way, the part of me that says, who cares, you know? So I'm just fragmented beyond belief. And as a memory or a thought, a song, a memory, just a remnant, you know, Bill in his story talks about vestiges of my old prejudice were enough to raise antipathy. A vestige is like a fossil. It's like a shadow of something. That's all we need to raise intense feelings of hate or intense feelings of remorse. We just need a teeny tiny thing to set the whole thing in motion. And what happened to me was something would flash in my mind and I could taste gunmetal. It went right to tasting gunmetal. And that would be hundreds of times a day. And, you know, Bill talks about how, was I crazy? I thought I was near being just that because of the lack of perspective. I could not control my thoughts. I scared myself. And then the third part of my bottom, well, I hit my bottom finally May 30th and I named it Norman. And that's because that was the man, Mr. Wright, that I met in Whiskers, because where else do I meet Mr. Wright? And all the signs were there. Same age, both lying to our families about being in recovery, never married, like to dance, doesn't matter if there's a band playing or not, you know, just dance anyway. But, you know, he was not quite exactly my type. Now, I've had a lot of types, but gay was never one of them. And I didn't know. I was his beard. Now, he thinks I'm a find, because I have a BMW and, you know, and money and all that. But he thinks I'm a find, which shows how delusional he is. But we're a match made in Whiskers. And, you know, within a week, I'm having a barbecue with my whole family to meet him. And he's studying medical science at Emory, except there is no such thing. And I'm the only one. I'm the only one that doesn't know that he's everybody in Whiskers knows that he's not at Emory. He works in the linens department at Rich's. And I'm mortified. First of all, he's late to the barbecue because he's coloring his hair. That doesn't tell me anything. My mother even says he's coloring his hair. I said, he's a metrosexual. He's very trendy. I just did not see any of the signs. And he invited me to go to this wedding in his family. And once the wedding happened, he was gone. I didn't even know it. A couple days later, I went to a concert with an old friend of mine. And this is why, if I remember my last drunk, that doesn't keep me sober, because I had a big time. I went to Lakewood, I had a limousine, I had friends, I had a host of friends, I had all kinds of powdered alcohol, and I had a big, big time. Now, the next morning was full of those, the four horsemen were hanging out in my living room. But the night before was fun. And when I woke up the next morning, it was guilt and remorse, because I found myself again with another person that I wasn't sure how they got there and how soon were they going to leave. And I've cheated on Norman. And how am I going to make this right? No, he's the one. And so I'm sitting in my living room just devastated and thinking, I got to do something here. And the thought came. Now, Bill talks about the thought coming, the great thought. There's a difference when he says, I think, or the thought came. And this was a thought that came. And it was just, why don't you go back to AA? And I thought, that's probably a good idea. And 3 days later, that's what I did. You know, I didn't want to rush into it or anything. And I called the woman who had 12-stepped me in that bar. And I said, she goes, wow, I haven't heard from you in a couple years. And I said, are you busy tonight? And she said, well, I'm exhausted. I'm going to go home and go to bed. I said, I'm going to go to 8111 and surrender. And she said, oh, thank God, I'll meet you there. And it turned out it was her 2-year anniversary. And she gave me her blue candle, and she said, give this back and to me in a year. And I started crying because I wanted nothing more than that, but I didn't know how I was going to do it. And all I knew was to keep going to meetings. And I wasn't praying for God to help me. I was just wishing and hoping something would. And the only two people I recognized from before were these two guys that were talking about surrendering and getting a sponsor and working the steps and having a change. And one was kind of a normal guy with a sports car, so that got my attention a little bit. And then there was this old guy that talked a lot about God, and that scared the crap out of me. And he was older, and I thought I could never have that. So somewhere in the middle, though, the message was the same. And I just kept coming to the meetings. And one day I heard this woman talk, and she told my story. And she talked about how she came from a decent family but ended up homeless and ended up being in a place she didn't want to be. And I thought, that's me. And she said that she came to meetings for a long time and ended up being almost homicidal and suicidal at the same time before she finally asked for help. And she asked someone, who had a knowledge of this book, who always had her book with her and was always talking about the book and how we have to self-diagnose. You know, she said, I heard her say, you know, I had people tell me all my life I was alcoholic, but until I understood what that was, it didn't do me any good. And when she talked, I was like, yeah, yeah, yeah. And then when she was done, I was too afraid to ask her to sponsor me. And then I'd see her again, and I'd go, yeah, yeah, yeah. And nobody else had that effect on me. And so finally, the third time I asked her, will you be my temporary sponsor? And she said, do you want temporary sobriety? I said, I can't even ask the right questions in this place, you know what I mean? And I said, well, no. She goes, well, I'll be your sponsor. She goes, are you an alcoholic? And I said, yes. And she said, are you willing to go to any length for victory over alcohol? And I said, yes. I didn't even know what that meant, but I said, yes. And she said, well, here's what I want you to do. I know what happened. She goes, have you been sober before? And I said, oh, I had about 90 days, but I chose to drink again. She goes, really? You chose to drink again? She goes, had you worked the steps? No. Did you have an effective mental defense? No. Did you have a higher power? No. She goes, what made you think you chose to drink again? It says right here, page 20, you know, we have lost the power of choice in drink. And the pain and the suffering of even a week or a month ago is not sufficient to keep us from the drink. And I was like, that's exactly what happened to me on those Sunday nights when I did not want to go to that bar and be the only woman in that bar on a Sunday night, but I couldn't not go. I hadn't chosen to drink. I thought, can I please change my answer? It's the first time someone had told me something I understood. I was drinking beyond my own will. And then I said, can you help me? She goes, yeah, here's what I want you to do. And she goes, I want you to start reading the book and diagnose yourself. She goes, the blank page, that's what you know about getting sober. She said, you know all about the drinking game and where to get your drinks, but you don't know anything about getting sober or you wouldn't have asked me to help you. I was like, already she knows so much. And then the title page, she told me, here's the first promise, a story how many thousands of men and women have recovered from alcoholism, past tense. I love that, because I have to tell you, when I hear people, and it's a matter of choice, and I'm not saying, but when I hear people say, I'm a recovering alcoholic, I think, when do we get over it? Because when I have the flu, I want to get over the flu. I don't want to have it for 20 years. So, as the book says, we recover from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. And my sponsor told me my eyes were dead like a shark's when I met her. And I don't think they're dead like a shark's tonight. And I don't taste gunmetal anymore. And I don't hate myself anymore. I sometimes, you know, I'm a little hard on myself, but I don't hate myself. And life isn't futile. You know, and I don't blame my parents for what happened to me. So she started to say things to me, and we started reading this book every Saturday morning. And I love where it said, you know, things like, as part of our rehabilitation, Bill presented these ideas to other alcoholics, pressing upon them, they must do likewise and still others. She said, that's your rehab, working with others. I didn't know how I was going to get there, but that made sense to me. That was something I could do. It wasn't just coming to meetings, sitting on my hands, and hoping I'm not smitten with the insane urge, you know? And I didn't like when people said, if I don't drink today, I'm a winner. Because in the beginning, it was all I could do to call her. She said, I want you to call me at a certain time. I want you to read in the book every day. And when you call me, tell me what page you're on. I want you to go to meetings a half hour early. I want you to sit in the front row. I had to start taking notes. I was like, oh my God, I'm in the weeds. I mean, I used to manage multiple restaurant units, and now I can't keep track of five simple directions. So I had to write it all down, and I had to carry an alarm clock with me because I didn't have an alarm on my cell phone. And because it was way back when, I had to go to payphones sometimes, so I had to memorize her number. But she was available to me at 5:30. That's why we did that. And it also got me used to picking up that 2-ton phone. She also had me meeting her other sponsees and sitting in the front row with them and bring my big book. Now, when I got sober, there wasn't a whole lot of people carrying big books around. And people would say, is this a big book meeting? And I said, no. And why'd you bring your book? And I said, my sponsor said, bring your AA book to an AA meeting. That made sense to me. I didn't know I wasn't doing it right. You know, I was just doing what she said. And that's why, like Chris says, we can follow the path. You know, rarely have we seen a person fail if it's thoroughly followed our path. Because that's one set of footprints. I can follow one. I can't follow all y'all. That's what I used to do, and I ended up here, there, and everywhere. I had a little pill that said, good girls go to heaven. The other side said, bad girls go everywhere. You know? And, you know, so she got me into action right away. And she told me, I want you to meet two people, say hello to two women every day. I'm like, oh my gosh. Look people in the eye and say hello. It was like, I can't do that unless I have a belly full of vodka. You know, I was terrified, but I've done it. And nobody has ever said, what are you doing saying hello to me? Not once has someone said, don't say hello to me. And I see people when I go to meetings, and they'll dutifully, like, get up and walk over and say, hello, I'm so-and-so. I was in a meeting out of town one time, and this woman walked around and said, hello. I thought, her sponsor told her she has to say hello to everybody in the room. I mean, I know why she's doing it. It was hard as hell for her, but I know why she was doing it, because her sponsor said so, you know? I had to go to meetings with her other sponsees, and they didn't like me because I was very compliant. I was an AA brown nose because my sponsor didn't care where she was. If they did something that was out of compliance, she didn't care who was in earshot, she was going to let them know. And not that she was mean, but she was very direct and truthful, and there was no way she was going to do that to me in front of a whole bunch of other people. So I just followed the rules. And before you knew it, she tricked me into getting sober. I mean, it was unbelievable. The book says, if you want, we have, and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you're ready to take certain steps. She decided when that day was, I had to meet her at her house, and she goes, you know why you're here? And I said, we're going to work some steps. And she said, I'm taking you through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said, all of them? And she goes, half measures avail us nothing, you know? And what she showed me was, I'd already been doing one and two. I'd already made these decisions. If I had been powerless over alcohol and my life is unmanageable, I get myself a manager. I had one of those. If I've come to believe that a power greater than me can restore me to sanity, then I'm following something that's more powerful than me, and I'm feeling better. And that was a fact. You know, I wasn't obsessing as much about alcohol. I was too busy being pissed off about all the directions my sponsor was giving me. And, you know, I had a friend who was like, oh, I got to buy my sponsor, and we go to Starbucks, you know, and half a meeting is better than no meeting. And I'm like, and I sit in the back, and like, and I, you know, I'll tell my sponsees, you were not in the front row. She goes, my friend is in the third row. I said, your friend is not responsible for your sobriety. You know, so I follow the rules. But that's what worked for me. The book even says we're not going to have a personality change unless we follow a few simple rules. And I like that, a personality change. You know, just enough to get over it. You know, and I didn't come to believe though at first. My sponsor used to say this, and I was like that. I came to suspect, because, man, you people were like a cult. And you're going to love me till I can love myself. And I thought, that's the biggest bunch of horse manure I ever heard. My sponsor said, I'll love you until you can love somebody else, because it's been about you all your life. And I was thinking, but I'm so low and depressed, and I've just had such a hard life. And she goes, you were living low. She wasn't accusing me. She was just saying the fact. I was living low. No wonder I felt so low. You know, if you want to feel self-esteem, do estimable things. So she sits me down. We say a prayer. We burn it. Say another prayer. We burn it. We read through the text. We get to the step. We do the step. We get to four. Now, in my lineage, we don't do the columns. We have cards. We answer questions. And they were developed by the home brewmeister, A.A. Clarence Snyder. And he found they were more provocative. They opened up the floodgates better. And that must be true, because the first question is, list all the most shameful, disgusting things you've ever done in your life, and don't leave out the stuff with animals and cousins. Now, once that one's out, the rest is pretty easy. And what I learn is, I'm driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity. When I'm afraid that you're going to judge me, I'm going to gossip about you. If I'm afraid you're not going to like me, I'm going to show off. So it doesn't look like I'm afraid. It looks like I'm a show off. So now that I know that about me, when I see someone showing off, I think, gosh, you know, they're probably afraid. You know, we're all very much alike on the inside. So I do this whole inventory, and then she shares her fist up with me, which allows me to open up more. And she goes, just read it, because I want to have a disclaimer before everyone. Well, before I start, just read it. You know, and so we just went through it, and then we got to burn it. You know, just give it to God. And you know, step five promises are about, you know, how it says the actor, you know, the alcoholic leads a double life, and his memories are like a nightmare. My name, and we just want to push them down inside ourselves, you know, and never see the light of day. But that causes for more tension and more drinking. I did not know the power in writing it and saying it. I didn't know until I did it. I didn't understand four until I'd finished four. And the effect of it was amazing, because I'd never done anything like it. I've never talked to a therapist. I was always fine. Thank you very much. I don't need your help. And so when I finally did this, the floodgates just opened. And of course, I heard that, you know, the emotions are the first to go and the first to come back. Last to go and the first to come back. And that was true. You know, it was crazy town for a while there. But I'm comfortable there. So then six and seven. For me, my sponsor said, your will in your life. Your will is what you think and what you want, and your life is what you do. She goes, here's your will in your life. Because when it said, you know, turn over your, it says about step three, you know, this is a very vital and crucial step, but unless immediately followed by four or five, you know, an effort to face and be rid of those things that are blocking us, has very little permanent effect. So that says we got to do four, five, six, seven, right along, right after, if we want the permanent effect. And six was a landing place for me. When she said, here's your will in your life, it's all on paper. How do you like that? I'm like, not so much, you know. And I was ready at that moment to have God remove these defects of character. I didn't have to work on step six. It was a landing place for me. Were is a state of being verb. And when I did it the way the book said, I was ready to have God remove it. Now, when God removes is sort of up to my willingness and his timing. And once I'm willing to admit a certain defect, it's amazing how, like, my first one was impatience. You know, I'm so impatient, so intolerant. So mom moved in, of course, right? And then later into sobriety, I started thinking, man, I swear too much. And in that first week that I even just said that, I swear too much, two people said, man, you swear a lot, you know? So it's like, as soon as I'm willing to admit it, the truth will come. You know, it says in here, the right answers will come if my house is in order. So if I want these things, if I can identify them, then they will happen for me. And God, you know, God will help remove. I don't work on my defects. I mean, they were given to me from birth. I think of a defect, you know, you ever hear about cars getting recalled, you know, defective, and you have to bring it in and get a part added. So I think of my defects as the gaps in my own character and my own being. And God adds the part that makes me okay. So I think my defects are purposely there to create a need for a bigger power, whether it's you, the advice of a good friend, the counsel of my sister, the truth out of a newcomer, which is really hard to hear, but the most powerful of all. So I believe those are there for a reason. If I didn't have defects, I wouldn't have a need for you, and I'd be in my self-constructed, isolated prison, which at first was comfortable, and then it was a horrible place to be. Seven, that seven-step prayer, kind of the same idea, you know, all of me good and bad, and learn how to use my liabilities to a better good. Step eight, that was easy because as I was doing my fifth step, my sponsor made the list. The book says we made the list as we took inventory. The list was done when my fifth step was done. And she goes, okay, who's the easiest person on this list to talk to? I said, my sister. She goes, great, see her within the week. Make an appointment, go see her. And she said, do your men's reading and we'll discuss it and here's what you say and give her a chance to speak. And my sister even said, can I just say I forgive you and all is well? I said, no, I got to go through it. Let me go through it, you know. Mm-hmm. So my men's were pretty easy, except that stuff happens. You know, I was introduced to a 10th step. And the 10th step, it says, we vigorously commence this way of living as we cleaned up the past. So as I'm beginning my amends process, I'm doing a 10th step. And they use the word inventory. Now, this is debatable, but in my experience, an inventory is written. I have never done an inventory in my head in my life. Now, I worked in a restaurant that had 11 sections of bar of liquor, seven shelves up. If you've ever been to Joey D's Oak Room, that's the inventory I used to take. I did not do that in my head. All right? And so if I want to really get a clear idea, I've got to write it down. The book, the 12 and 12 says, we are not good at self-reflection. Fifth step says, we think a solitary self-appraisal is insufficient. I hate that because it's right. You know? So I continue to take this personal inventory, and it says, continue to watch for fear, resentment, dishonesty, self-centeredness. These are the things that get me drunk. These are the causes and conditions of my alcoholism. And I'm a big fear-driven person. That was my big thing. Fear, 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 fear. I didn't know I was fearful. My brother thought I was the bravest person on earth. So did I, until I realized, oh my gosh, I'm scared of everything. So I have to look at it, and it doesn't say if these crop up, it says when. I have alcoholism, not alcoholism. And when I started doing my 10th step, two years into it, I was talking with a friend, and we had a mutual friend who was dying of cancer who was in the program, and his friend who was dying said, you know, I'm really, really grateful for the 9th step because I'm good to go. And as soon as he said it, I thought, oh, me too, except for that Luann thing. And I had insulted my best friend through her parents. She wasn't even there. They said, well, I went to a wedding and they said, Luann sends her best. I said, oh, she was mean. And, you know, I just vomited all this stuff all over. Like, whoa, she just said hello, you know? And I just knew that I had to clean that up. And in fact, so I told my sponsor about it. I came up on my 10th step, you know, and she said, well, what are you going to do? I said, I guess I'm going to call Luann. And Luann lived in upstate New York and I'm down here. And I called her one day and I said, hi, Luann. She said, Lordy, Lordy, Meredith McCabe. I'm like, oh my gosh, that's not the Luann I knew. No Lordy, Lordy, not that Luann. And she said, I said, I am working my ninth step in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I just wanted to talk to you for a few minutes. She goes, my husband has been in AA for 9 years. I know all about the ninth step. Wow. And just like that, it was fixed. And I saw her a few months later, and we went on a canoeing trip, and got all caught up, and her birthday's tomorrow, and we're friends now, and it's, you know, years of feuding are fixed in just a very short time, just like the book promises. You know, step 11 and 12, the book teaches me that I grow spiritually, not through prayer and meditation, but through work and self-sacrifice for others, which was not easy for me. I remember reading about it all over and over again, vital to permanent recovery, strenuous work with alcoholics, you know, perfect and enlarge our spiritual life, the work and self-sacrifice for others. I'm like, oh my gosh, but I could do it. I didn't like doing it, but I could do that. And I liked the book, so I could sit with someone and go over the book. So I could give my time to that, because I got a payoff, frankly. And what I find is, I don't forgive myself. I know that in my belief, things happen for a reason, and I am forgiven, but I don't forgive myself. But in service to others, and in giving to others what was freely given to me, I am healed. I don't know how that happens, but God shows up in those moments. And he shows up in other moments, too, just when I feel like I just need a little something. I don't even know I need a little something until I get it. I was running. I started running when I got sober, mostly because I was going through a depressing time, and I knew that running made me feel better. And I was running down the road, and this car passed with this mom in the front and this little blonde girl in the back. And she just turned and watched me with the biggest smile for the longest time, until she was out of sight. And I just watched her, and I just started crying. It was the craziest thing. But it was like an old soul in that little face just letting me know you are loved. You know, it was, and you know, the thing about that is, if I want to look for all the bad in people, I'll find it. You know, just like Bill, you know, the devil is the boss universal, you know. But when you get clear out of the garbage that blocks us, you know, it says we're blocked from the sense of his presence. One of my favorite promises is in the fourth step, right before we do the fourth step, I think it's on page 47. No, I'm wrong. Amy, don't correct me on that, all right? Okay. They're talking about getting ready to do a first step. We finally saw that faith in some kind of God was a part of our makeup just as much as a feeling we have for a friend. Sometimes we had to search fearlessly, but he was there. He was as much a fact as we were. We found the great reality deep down within us. In the last analysis, it is only there that he may be found. I never looked for God inside. Look for them on top of mountains, next to rivers, sometimes in the back of a car, but not so much. But in the last, it's the last place I look. It's the last place I look, of course, and it's inside. I tap into an unsuspected inner resource, and what it says is, we can only clear the ground a bit. If our testimony helps sweep away prejudice, old ideas, right, preformed ideas, without enough information, enables you to think honestly, encourages you to search diligently, which means with effort, within yourself, search within yourself. Then if you wish, you can join us on the broad highway. Don't worry, another hour will be done. With this attitude, you cannot fail. The consciousness of your belief is sure to come to you. And what that tells me is it doesn't matter how much you suspect, doesn't matter how much you don't believe, doesn't matter all that. If you do this with as much diligence as you possibly can, something's going to happen, and you are going to believe something. The thing I really needed to believe was there, I sort of suspected there was a God, but I needed to know it. And that's what the 12 steps gave me. I know it. I know there's something bigger than me. And it gives my life more purpose. I'm part of something bigger. We all want to be part of something bigger. We don't realize that, but we do. You know, I used to suffer with, go away, go away, go away, come here, come here, go away, go away, come here, come here. You know, I didn't want to be alone, but then but I didn't feel comfortable. This leveled the playing field for me somehow. This process somehow gave me the secret handshake. Now, and it goes along, but here's the thing. AA is not a promise of the car, the truck, the marriage, the kids, because I was sober 10 years, and I didn't even have fear of financial insecurity on my first inventory, because I had plenty of money. It didn't even come up. But 10 years sober, everything fell apart, and I started losing things, material things, and it really put me in a bad way, and I realized that I had aligned my sense of importance with my position. Even though I was doing big book studies, sponsoring a lot of people, doing all that, staying very active, I had gotten away from my time spent in quiet time, meditating, reading about the God of my understanding, and I was really worshiping my work. And when that fell apart, I fell apart. And I had to seek other therapy. Just like the book says, upon therapy, we don't have a monopoly, you know? And I saw other therapy because I was so fearful, I could not pull myself out of bed. Now, how do you tell people that you've been sponsoring, oh, by the way, I'm too depressed to get out of bed, you know? That happened to me. I didn't drink, but I wasn't a winner either, you know? And I learned to have to trust God more and to give more to that. And slowly things have been taken from me so that I can understand what's really, really important. And I've been given a phenomenal gift in that those things don't fetter me anymore. I have no fear. I have full confidence that God will take care of things and that even in the bad times, I'm going to be all right. My goal has always been to be able to have peace in the storm, you know, to be asleep in the boat, you know, during the storm. Or one of my spiritual heroes says, I have learned to be content in plenty and in want. And if I can have that kind of contentment, then I don't have to be the little nervous Nelly I always was. And I can help you and I can engage. And in those moments, I am connected and I feel a sense of importance. And I don't mean like a, you know, a show-offy kind of, but a importance in the scheme of life, in the little ways we connect. And, you know, it's funny, when I changed my major from nursing to theater and English, I also dabbled a little stand-up comedy, and I used to think, man, I could be a famous comedian, I could make a lot of money, and of course I know that I would have gone by the way of John Belushi, because my heart was so desperate for, you couldn't fill me up, you know, with enough accolades. I'd still go home alone and drink myself into oblivion. But I think it's funny that one of my gifts is I'm able to express myself, and after I get over the original jitter, you know, hopefully carry a message of hope, you know, because this does work. You know, we have to, if we live by these principles and practice this and not afraid to share it with other people and be accountable to someone else, we get better. And we can survive the certain trials and low spots ahead. I've been quoting page 15 lately to my sponsees. Page 15 of Bill's story, there's 9 ways from Sunday how life is going to suck sober. All right? And I think that's important to know because we don't get a promise that it's going to be perfect every day. But it says things like, you know, even Bill, I was plagued by waves of self-pity and resentment that nearly drove me to drink. But I soon found that when all other measures failed, work with other alcoholics would save the day. Many times I've gone to my old hospital in despair. On talking to a man there, I would be amazingly lifted up and set on my feet. He does the footwork and somehow he's lifted up. Something outside of him lifts him up. It talks about pressure and difficulty we overcome, impossible domestic situations, feuds and bitterness, trouble and misery. You know, these are some of the promises we're going to have as sober people. But it just goes to show that if we do this, we can do it successfully and accept it as part of life. And in overcoming those things, not just squeaking by day to time, but overcoming, prevailing, surmounting, we have a whole new outlook on life. I'm really, really grateful to Alcoholics Anonymous. It's given me every good thing. I'd like to let the book have the last word. This is from The Family Afterward. And it says, those of us who have spent much time in the world of spiritual make-believe have eventually seen the childishness of it. This dream world has been replaced by a great sense of purpose, accompanied by a growing consciousness of the power of God in our lives. We have come to believe He would like to keep us to keep our heads in the clouds with Him, but that our feet ought to be firmly planted on earth. That is where our fellow travelers are, and that is where our work must be done. These are the realities for us. We have found nothing incompatible between a powerful spiritual experience and a life of sane and happy usefulness. Thank you very much.